From Liv Consulting, this is Cannabis Business Minds with your hosts, Kristen Yoder and Simone Simaluka-Radzins.
On this episode of Cannabis Business Minds, we're talking about Oregon lab testing and some upcoming regulation that is going to impact and already has impacted both cannabis operators and the public.
And considering it's such an integral part of regulation in any state, but especially its effects that it's had on Oregon, we have three guests with us instead of just one to provide us with a more comprehensive view of the current state and where they're going in Oregon.
So who we have today, we've got Cedar Gray. He's the CEO of Siskiyou Sun Grown. We've got Bethany Sherman, who's the CEO of OG Analytical Lab. And we've got Kevin Walsh, Managing Director of CO2 Company.
Yes, so that was obviously just us saying your name. So we'll give each one of you a turn to give a little background on you if you want to start, Cedar.
Okay. Well, like you guys mentioned, I'm the CEO and co-founder of Siskiyou Sun Grown. 3 years ago, my wife and I founded Siskiyou Sun Grown. We are OLCC processors and producers. We have a tier two farm here in the Williams Valley in the Siskiyou Mountains of Southern Oregon. We grow entirely organically. I've been using and cultivating cannabis since the 1980s. Siskiyou Sun Grown's flagship product is a decarboxylated oil, commonly known as Rick Simpson oil. I've recently been serving on the OHA Rules Advisory Committee on Testing, and that's where I first became aware of the proposed changes that we'll be discussing today.
Awesome. Thank you. Bethany, what about you?
Sure. I am the founder and CEO, as you mentioned, of OG Analytical, which is an analytical laboratory that does consumer safety and regulatory compliance testing for the cannabis industry. We're based in Eugene, Oregon, and we've been in business since early 2014. Mm-hmm. We are fully OLCC licensed and OLAP accredited for every regulatory compliance service for testing cannabis in the state of Oregon. We kind of established ourselves early on in this industry as being specialists in pesticide testing. So we focused a lot on driving the industry toward a more robust pesticide testing and consumer safety regulatory schema regarding pesticide testing for cannabis. That included, I was also a co-founder for the Cannabis Safety Institute and was on the Rules Advisory Committee for lab testing when the original October 1 draft rules, or excuse me, the October 1 rules were implemented. We've done a lot of work, I think, with the legislature to try to promote good consumer safety testing, with also trying to balance how to maintain a robust and successful market at the same time.
Awesome. And Kevin, what about you, last but not least?
My name's Kevin Walsh, one of the founding partners and the managing director of the CO2 company. We've been in operation since early 2014 with the launch of House Bill 3460, allowing dispensaries and more businesses to open up in the state of Oregon. We recently received our OLCC processing and wholesale licenses, and we've been kind of at the forefront, at least on the processing and producer side, of educating farmers and processors on the potential realities of compounds in extracts and how that relates from the farm to the processor. We have a couple years of really amazing data of working with a lot of outdoor farmers in Southern Oregon, seeing that a lot of the compounds we've been failing in our process are not the super gnarly ones that are in the news, but a lot of these are OMRI-listed, organic, so to say, compounds. And so our business has been very focused on education with the farmers, processors, and the consumers.
For all of us that don't know, I mean, you guys clearly, you're OLC licensed, you've understood you are participating so much into the Oregon community, right? And can you walk us through the evolution of, you know, Measure House HB 91 or Measure 91 passes? You know, took a while. It took, I think, almost 9 months before, you know, something was enacted. Walk us through the timeline, will you, of, you know, the initial passing as it relates to regulation and pesticides and why we're having this discussion right now.
My take on it and our company's stance and my observations of watching the initial proposed rules was for, is it 64 compounds that are being tested?
We have 59 on our current list.
59? So when the initial proposed rules came out for the 59, that was 2015, I want to say. We watched a multitude of labs pop up in the state. And as our company, we started working with multiple labs, testing products. Some of it was out of ease of distance. Some of it was out of marketing and reputation. We started working with a handful of different labs, and we met Bethany from OG Analytical and also Roger, the her partner, and started seeing some of the signs coming out of there. We watched. It felt like labs were beginning to test for, say, dairy products, but they were testing for eggs. They weren't testing for the lactose and the casein. So there was a lot of false readings going around the industry for a lot of 2015 and 2016. We were seeing, you know, we were bringing in material, we would fail it through OG, and it would get sold to a competitor and be on the shelf, you know, weeks later.
Wow.
And this past year, 2016, when they initiated the rules to get ORLAP certified, and there began to be a more of a level playing field with the labs. One, it felt good on our company standpoint that there was actually some standards to be held to in the lab scene. I don't know if that was a good explanation of that.
Well, the lab is the regulator, essentially, right? So you need regulations for the regulators.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I can jump in here, we got our start in early 2014 when the dispensary law came into effect. The very first set of cannabis testing rules that came into effect required that all cannabis that were sold through dispensaries had to be tested for potency, mold, and pesticides. But it only required that we test for four broad classifications of pesticides, which there are literally thousands of pesticide compounds within those four broad classifications. And it's completely untenable to think that any laboratory could test for every single one of those pesticides. And so what that did was it left labs to pick and choose which pesticide compounds they wanted to test for. So we might have, for example, I like to relate this to aquaponics because it's a little bit easier to digest. So for example, if a lab was required to test for fruits, nuts, vegetables, and legumes, for example, you might have one laboratory that's testing for strawberries, pecans, celery, and lentils. And you might have another one that's testing for blueberries and carrots and almonds and lima beans or something. So you have two different sets of labs testing two different sets of things, but both of them might be compliant. You have a producer going to one lab and having a test done where there might be some contamination in it, but it's not getting found because the lab's just not testing for it. And then you might have them go to another lab and have it get caught. Or then we have this alternative option or this alternative issue in that at that point the labs weren't, there's no oversight or regulation over the labs. So who's to say that those labs are even qualified or have the appropriate instrumentation to do that testing? So there was a good possibility then that any number of pesticide contaminants could be marked to place and still fall under the regulatory compliance requirements.
Kevin, you mentioned originally that there's like 64 compounds, and then Bethany, you know, you're like, okay, there's 59. How is this comparing with Colorado and with Washington? I remember reading, you know, that Oregon had a lot of, like, the list of pesticides was relatively long.
Yeah, to be clear, neither Washington or Colorado currently require pesticide testing.
Wow.
What?
They have pesticide testing regulations, so producers are not allowed to use them, but the labs they're not required to have pesticide testing done before the finished product goes to market. It's more of a like a regulatory compliance thing, where if they use something, they have to put it on a label, and then if they get caught, there's a potential for recalls. And so we've seen a lot of recalls happening in Colorado specifically, but also in Washington because of this.
Wow.
So I think that's why to Oregon, because Oregon actually has these substantial pesticide testing regulations with a specific list. So there's a level playing field. All the labs are looking for the same list of pesticides, and we're reducing that potential for recalls to happen because we're catching things before it goes to market.
It's just too bad that Oregon had to be the playing ground where you learn how much, you know, how much required pesticide testing will shut down a market. You know, it's probably one of the reasons they haven't required it in Washington and Colorado, is it's such a big undertaking.
Yeah. And also, I mean, one of the things we were talking with Jeff Raber from the workshop last episode, and I mean, the question is like how the regulations for the labs, right? And if people are looking at pecans and pistachios, and how does that all make sense? So you kind of painted this picture of, okay, this is what was the original requirement. And then will you talk to us a little bit about, you know, that's kind of what you had to do in the very beginning. And then we remember reading, and I'm sure probably a lot of you faced this, what happened in October with the bottleneck of lab testing and you know, companies going out of business? And how does that relate to what we're talking about right now? Cedar, do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, starting in October, the new ORLAP accreditation took effect. Labs that test for pesticides for the full compliance test need to have ORLAP accreditation. And initially, were there two labs with ORLAP accreditation for pesticides for a few weeks there?
October 1, yeah, there were only two. It took OG Analytical, we weren't accredited until October 12th, so it took us a couple days to get in there too.
Okay. And so so a bottleneck definitely occurred in testing early on, particularly with pesticide testing. I think some unfortunate things may have happened in the industry then. My understanding is that there was tremendous pressure to get more labs accredited. My understanding is that now there are questions about the thoroughness of the accreditation process for some of those later labs. That process may have been rushed, and it was definitely occurred under a tremendous political pressure. There's plenty of labs accredited now. I believe multiple labs are operating under capacity. But we still have an issue where there's an issue of confidence in the labs. We're still having an issue where, many within the industry believe that there are labs that you can go to get the results that you want to, not necessarily the true results. I believe that, strong lab oversight with teeth would take care of this. I think that, I don't lay the blame anywhere, because I think this entire process has been an amazing pioneering process. Mm-hmm. We're, inventing something here that hasn't existed before. So I cut everyone in the, all segments of the industry slack. Mm-hmm. But now I do believe we need to have lab oversight with teeth in order to bring mm-hmm. you know, industry and consumer confidence in the labs. There's, you know, there's plenty of accredited labs operating, but there are still some questions about the consistency of their procedures and results.
Yes. I actually worked for Jeffrey Raber at the workshop. And I've been in the cannabis industry 11 years myself. And there is, I mean, when the lab is made the regulator, but then no one's watching them, they have great power, and it's a lot easier for a lab to charge less money and give favorable results and get more business than a lab that charges more, does it correctly, and prevents a company from going to market or having to destroy their entire crop.
Yeah.
So, and I've talked to Jeff about it. He said that you have to do the same exact standardized procedures and from the same library of molecules. Or I am not a scientist, for the record, so I'm not totally sure what I'm saying, but you have to do it exactly the same at each place to even get the same results in the first place. And in California, we're totally not regulated. All the labs test differently, unfortunately, and it's like, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah, get regulated.
Especially when formulating, how do you know which result to trust?
Yeah. And so I remember in Oregon, you've done process validation. So I think some of the earlier stakeholders would go get their entire process validated through the lab. Kevin, can you explain kind of your, you know, walk us through how your company did that? You know, when you understood the regulations and how you would work with the lab and if you had to get your process validated?
Yeah, that process we've been working on for probably about 16 months.
Wow.
With the initial proposed rules, the I pulled up a little bit of data of some of the stuff we had from 2016 of the amount of material that comes through our system that we did return, and these are rough numbers, but it's a pretty good general assumption of it's roughly, we had, I won't go into weights, but out of the material that came in, we had 58% of it passed, you know, no detection of any kind of pesticides through our extraction process. And the other 42% was a fail. And it was quite a bit of material, and seeing the ability to not cross-contaminate material, which can happen so easily when testing in the parts per million, the parts per billion, and extraction levels, using different solvents, small drops of material will cross-contaminate entire batches of, you know, 5-10 pounds of oil. It doesn't take much to ruin. Mm-hmm. And we've been working on that process for about a year and a half. And it hasn't been easy, but it, at the same time, it's not impossible. It's not rocket science. It's all based off of other industries and what they've had to do to comply with FDA and other regulatory systems that, you know, mm-hmm. govern our food and drink and water. The process validation, too, I guess, you know, a lot of the stuff we've been working on came, we started looking at the peanut butter industry had one of the largest recalls in U.S. history that had contaminated material go into about 4,000 different products, and it was almost $1 billion recall. And we started looking at some of their systems and hired on a couple chemists and specialty folks to help us build a very robust quality control system.
Yeah.
That now we're pretty confident, very confident in.
That's really smart. And that's another, with the cannabis industry being so new, mm-hmm. we forget we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other industries that are already held to a higher standard that we could learn from. So that was really smart.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, and two, I guess that to finish that point, you know, the proposed rules that are beginning to come down the pipeline right now, it's, you know, we're not a heavily funded company. We haven't taken outside money. We're bootstrapping Oregonians that have been at this, you know, since the laws have allowed. And we've built these systems that do work. we haven't failed a final test in quite a while. Mm-hmm. And it's nice. Not impossible. It just takes time, hard work, and patience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's doable.
Yeah, it's doable. And so I guess I want to hear a little bit more about, you know, what can people be doing to do that? I mean, I think the misconception is that, oh my God, I'm going to go out of business. Like, what happens? Like, you failed a test, right? That's significant. How do you recoup from that as an operator? And how can we explain to people that this is a very important thing, not only for public health and safety, but just as an industry as a whole? And, you know, Bethany mentioned that this is, you know, Oregon is like one of the strictest in states doing it. So clearly that's why we're seeing some of the hiccups. But can you elaborate on how does that impact your business? Kevin, Cedar, if you guys both, I don't know who wants to go first, but you know, if you're failing something, how can you recover from that and still move on?
Well, my answer is pretty short and sweet because we've never failed the test.
Boom, do it right.
Yeah, we're vertically integrated. We only process what we grow, and we grow organically. The area that we live in is a pristine environment. And so in 3 years and 150 tests, we've never failed the test. That being said, you know, we could be oversprayed fortunately, we don't have road crews spraying the roads around us. We don't have forestry crews spraying the forests around us. The surrounding properties don't have agriculture going on, so we're in an excellent environment. But, for example, say our neighbor did something unsafe and we were oversprayed, on our field, because we're vertically integrated and we depend on our crop for our processing, you know, that could be potentially devastating for us.
I think
of the big lessons for all newcomers into the industry is it's absolutely crucial to do all of the due diligence possible, above and beyond the due diligence, to make sure that your production methods are going to be clean. Because as Kevin mentioned, we're talking about parts per million and parts per billion. So you need to examine every single possible contamination source in your production.
Wow. I never thought about how easy it would be to get contaminated, but that's a really good point.
And it depends on the compound. I mean, for us, we're not vertically integrated. We work with, over the past, it's probably been in the range of 60 to 75 farms on a pretty regular basis in the medical market. OLCC, there's a lot more production. It's a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. We'll be slimming down to probably under 10 farms that we work with. But we've developed questionnaires that are hybrids out of the Oregon Tilth program, you know, that go over everything from every pesticide used when, you know, looking at your seed and clone stock. If you have a clone that's coming from a clone farm that was dipped in a clone gel that had mycobutanol and it's a systemic compound, I will see it in the extract 9 months later in an outdoor crop. If you're using a big one that was used a few years ago was product that contains spinosad, which is no longer allowed in Oregon, but we saw if it was used outdoor in August, it would fail our tests for a harvest in October. But if it was used in July, we'd find no detection.
Wow.
And that's the breaking down of the compounds under sunlight and normal conditions.
Do you have a pretty thorough process then when you are onboarding, you know, a potential vendor, like your own, due diligence and compliance to ensure? Or like, how does it work also in Oregon? Are you required to get it lab tested before you can take possession of it to extract?
For extraction, no. Currently, that's not the case. I can take in from the recreational market, product, byproduct or flower that's not tested, bring it into my facility, do our quality control tests on it, mm-hmm. and determine if I want it or not. The new proposed rules, my understanding is, if the material is tested and comes into my facility, I don't have to test my extract either.
Hmm. Interesting.
Bethany, can you talk to us about, you know, this new revision to the rules? You being from the lab world, I would love for you to kind of elaborate, like, what does this mean? What are the changes? And just walk us through that.
Sure. So the pre-October 1 rules required that 100% of products that were tested batches had to be tested for before being brought to market. The October 1 rule suggested that every 10-pound batch of flours had to be tested, and then all concentrates and edibles, topicals, things like that had to undergo the process validation before being able to take the product to market. We've had three rollbacks on those rules already, and this is the fourth rollback that we're looking at. The way the rules stand today after our first three rollbacks is that we now test 33% of all the flower batches that go to market. So one out of every three 10-pound batches gets tested of flower. And we rolled back the process validation to something called a control study, which is a modified version of the process validation that's a bit more accessible and it's less testing. So rather than the process validation was three batches of 20 tests, the control study is based on the batch size and can be anywhere from 4 to 32 samples. And I think that makes it definitely more accessible for the producer. Once they've got the control study done, then they only have to test a field primary and a field duplicate. The temporary rules the draft rules that are being proposed now would cut the flower testing down from one in every three batches to one in every five batches. And then it would also reduce, like Kevin said, the pesticide testing on concentrates to once a year, provided that the concentrate manufacturer was making a product from flower that was already tested. I think,
which is insane.
Well, I don't want to interrupt, but like when you just told us that something tests different in June and August, same thing. Like that's once a year is a little. Like, we like to do operational, that's insane. Once a year is not enough from an audit perspective of anything.
Yeah. And two, on our part, we do have a wholesale division. So we deal a lot with tested final flower,
yeah,
trim, and extracts. And we've seen it time and time again. A flower, there'll be no detection. On the trim, if we test the trim, which gets expensive just doing a raw trim test, we might see something there, but when we extract it, 50% of the time there's something there.
So
and
the
it's
thing is,
like failing level.
The thing is about this is that when concentrate manufacturers are extracting, so the whole purpose of the extraction, right, is to concentrate the cannabinoids that you're interested in. So mm-hmm. we're looking for a high THC product, we're looking for a high CBD product. So we extract it with CO2 or butane or whatever other solvent or solventless method that the producer's making. The idea is to concentrate the cannabinoids. Well, you're not just concentrating the cannabinoids, you're also concentrating any pesticide contamination that's in it. So you might have a trace level of this pesticide contamination in the flower or the trim material that's possibly even not detectable at lab testing. And then once it's extracted, it's way over the limit. So that really, that in of itself makes this new proposed rule change. In my opinion, it's an egregious violation of consumer safety and protection.
Yeah.
Of consumer safety.
What I wonder about this is who picks the sample to get tested? Could it be that the cultivators are like, oh, like, let's take this bud that has the best looking trichomes or whatever, or depends where they took it from to make sure that they get better results. Like, where's the quality control on the actual samples?
That's a great question. So before October 1, the producer could bring in their sample if they wanted to. As of October 1, the only people who can do the sampling have to be accredited by ORLAP for their sampling protocol. And today that's just the laboratories. We do have some laboratories that have popped up just to do the sampling. They've gotten accredited just for sampling. Mm-hmm. And laboratories can subcontract to those sampling labs, but the sampler does have to be accredited for the sampling protocol.
That's comforting, I think. You can take a sample from anywhere, but mm-hmm. it's good to have generally a non-interested party be the go-between.
Yeah. Question though, Oregon, I mean, it's an independence. Lab and security, in my mind, should always be independent from just, you know, segregation of duties. Can you have any other license if you have a license for a lab in Oregon?
That's a good question. I don't think I know the answer to that.
I hope not, because you don't want that. That's the point. Like, you don't want to. It's like, who's good? I mean, you. It's like, oh, I'm going to audit. It's just, that doesn't make sense. You need to have yourself, and you're going to find, you know, you're going to pass with flying colors and not look at something.
Yeah.
Cedar, what do you think for you? I know you're vertically integrated, but how does this impact you? What are your thoughts on this upcoming proposed regulation?
I think it would be absolutely devastating to the industry. I probably sound dramatic when I say that, but I absolutely believe in the creation of an organic industry. I think that we have an opportunity here to create an industry that will be a model worldwide, not only for cannabis production, but for food production. The standards that we started out with here on October 1st, I believe are some of the strictest standards in any industry in the world. And I'm really proud of that. And there's many companies, small companies and large companies, that are demonstrating they're passing all of their tests, or they're cleaning up their supply chains if they weren't, and they're showing that it's absolutely possible to do successful business with rigorous pesticide testing. Our company, Siskiyou Sungrown, has developed a solid reputation for clean product. Because of that, we're able to sell our product at a premium. If this proposed rules change took effect, our company would actually lose significant value, mm-hmm. because the painstaking work that we have gone into clean production would no longer have a value in this industry. To me, that would be extremely frustrating, both personally and professionally. Yeah. I think this idea of, you know, once a year random testing is very close to no testing at all. Mm-hmm. What about those producers who get, or those processors who get tested in January or February? You know, for the rest of the year, they can be pretty confident that they're not going to be tested. And, you know, the good actors, I think this is a key point, is these rules are not made for the good actors in the industry. The good actors in the industry mm-hmm. are already producing and processing clean product. Mm. These rules are made for the bad actors in the industry, and there's no way that anyone can pretend that there are not bad actors in the industry, because 50% of the product is dirty. Yeah. Now, I don't imply that all of that product was intentionally produced using unsafe methods, but with 50% fail rates, mm-hmm. I think it's clear that there are many bad actors in this industry, and we need to clean it up. Kevin's talked about the peanut recall. Mm-hmm. Recently, there's been news, there was a massive recall of cannabis products in Canada, mm-hmm. and the company that sold the contaminated products was absolutely unable to trace the source of the contamination. I think that would open up Oregon agencies and Oregon companies to, mm-hmm. you know, not only recalls, but lawsuits, and in the current political climate, possible federal intervention.
Yeah, exactly.
And unfortunately, the threat is necessary for people to grow correctly. California is like 90% dirty, if not more. I quit smoking and dabbing altogether, which is crazy, because I don't trust anything in California anymore unless it's comprehensively screened. And like you were saying, it will cost more. The product costs more because you're paying for quality. Mm-hmm. And why would somebody pay for better product when
they don't know it's
better
product?
Yeah, then there's nothing really setting you apart.
Okay, but I mean, like, from the finance perspective, and, you know, Kevin is a great example, like, you know, no capital backing, he's running a company, a successful one, bootstrapping it, he's still okay with this, right? And I think that, you know, you listen to opposition, oh my God, it's just going to put us out of business, it's going to change the price, people are going to go to the black market. Talk to us why that's not true.
I'm not saying that's not true. Oh. That is happening around the industry. People are going out of business. People are diverting. Mm-hmm. It's definitely, it's a hard time right now.
Okay.
Very hard.
But with this new impact of pesticides, or, you know, like this proposed regulation of, you know, reducing the amount of time to test, I mean, what are the costs associated with it? That's what I mean. Like, is it a material cost that could tip somebody from going out of business?
For us, I think on the cost per gram, I think it's definitely increased. I mean, it's not astronomical. It's, mm-hmm. you know, we're looking in the, it's definitely under $1 per gram. I want to say it's off the top of my head, I want to say it's like 40 cents a gram is what it costs us to do 3 screens of testing, a pre, a mid, and a final.
Yeah.
On the size of batches. We've had to increase, it's caused us to scale up and force us to get a little bigger to handle the volume, you know, discounts, because there is, I believe the our proposed rules where if it's, you know, 5 pounds of oil versus 10 pounds of oil, there's a certain amount of sampling that needs to happen. So we've had to, our business models have had to change and get a little larger to deal with some of these costs.
Bethany, from your perspective, will you anticipate that these, you know, it stays with the same, you know, like what's happening right now and the proposed regulation doesn't go through, do you think that would impact some of the operators that you're working with? And if so, what would you suggest of why it's still important?
Well, I think that, first of all, this is still a fledgling industry. Mm-hmm. We still have a lot of producers out there who are new. Most of us are new. OG Analytical is only 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And we're all still trying to figure this whole thing out. There's a lot of new producers in the market that have never even heard of GMP, good manufacturing practices. And I think that CO2 Company has actually been a really good example of implementing good manufacturing practices when they hired a chemist. They're the only company yet who's come in and done an audit of our lab. Like we encourage people to do that type of work. You should have a chemist who knows what they're doing that comes in to make sure before we had regulations overlap, CO2 Company had their chemist come in and who was knowledgeable about analytical chemistry, come in and look at all of our paperwork, look at all of our methods, look at everything that we do and make sure that we're doing a good job. And not only that, but with the implementation of their micro extraction method, which is part of their good manufacturing practices, they're able to isolate any potential issues with the product before they actually purchase that giant batch of flour to convert it into the concentrate. So I think that's a implementation of things like GMP are going to help any producer to be able to be successful under a heavily regulated market. And I think that, you know, with all of us being so new to this, most people are just not familiar with that. And we also had the first 3 years of operation where we were not regulated at all. Mm-hmm. And we got used to that schema where the testing was really inexpensive. It was really fast because there was a lot of labs competing for market share. Mm-hmm. And now that we have the regulation and we have fewer labs in the market because fewer labs have been able to prove their competence to do this work. And there's a lot more work to do now that the labs are accredited. The cost of testing has gone up. Hmm. The turnaround time has extended. And I think there's been a lot of pushback against these rules simply because of those two things. And people I think that the industry just kind of got spoiled during that time that we didn't have regulation. And now that it's here, it's an opportunity for us to really start to legitimize the industry as we mature as companies within this industry trying to find success. I think as we see with both Cedar and Kevin's cases that, and these are not the only two producers in the state of Oregon too who have been successful under this. We have a lot of clients who have been able to achieve success under the current regulations with getting their product to market by you know, implementing good business practices. Yep. and making sure that that they can produce a clean product and get it tested. And we've heard also, so in regards to the cost of the testing itself, Again, it depends on how large your batch size is. If we have to test one in every three 10-pound batches, if you've got a 2-pound batch, obviously it's going to be a little bit more expensive than if you have a 10-pound batch. Same thing with your concentrates. We've heard from industry specifically that it's not actually the cost of the testing that's the issue. It's the cost of lost product. Hmm. So when the laboratory finds pesticides and the producer can't get the product to market, you know, they've lost all of that, especially if they're not doing a micro extraction like what Kevin's company is doing. If they've purchased 100 pounds of flour and converted that all to mm-hmm. a concentrate, that's a big, big loss for that company. So I think that it's really going to be important for the players in the industry to implement systems like that. Yeah. To help make sure that they're not experiencing those heavy losses. And I think that it's really, the current regulations are really tenable. I do think that there's some things that could be fixed. It's obviously not a perfect solution. Mm-hmm. There actually are a few things in the proposed rule changes that make a lot of sense. One thing that the current rules do not allow currently is remediation of failed products. And that to me just is ridiculous. Yeah. And the proposed rules do allow for remediation. And so there's a couple little things I would love to see implemented, but the reduction in pesticide testing really just doesn't make sense for this industry.
Agreed.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I'm all about that. And I think you hit it on the head. It's that, and that's what I think I was trying to point out, is that I understand that the cost to test is expensive, but when you can run a business well and you have, you know, you're bootstrapped, but you're efficient and you've managed the process and you have best practices and you've done something like Kevin's done where you, you know, do a mini test and you go in first and you've really thought about your business in that way, then this could be costly, but it's not a significant portion. It's not material. And that's, I think, what I was waiting to hear, because I know that people might be thinking it's super costly. Yeah, but if you can really manage everything, you'll be able to do it.
And not by losing your material if you fail and then you don't have anything to show for it. That's a really good incentive to have GMP structure so that you're able to operate. And it's only fair that those who do operate correctly succeed and those who don't fail.
Yeah, no, I mean... We're like the justice people.
Yeah, but. Well, as someone who dabs, I mean, pesticide concentration, that's crazy, you know? That's a health issue.
Well, and that was our next question is, for those of us or those listeners who are out there that don't realize why we're emphasizing this, why we're having a special podcast for you guys, the importance of lab testing, the importance of pesticides.
Quality control.
Talk to us about why we care, why we need to care. Mm-hmm.
I can start on this one. So I think there's a lot of reasons why we should care, but to start, a lot of people like to compare cannabis with food, and there's a big suggestion out there that cannabis is tested way more than food is tested, and that it's unnecessary that we test cannabis so much. But that's flawed, and for a couple of reasons. Number one, it doesn't account for the fact that our system processes toxins differently if we eat it versus smoke it. When you eat a product, a toxin, your body's organs filter most of that toxin out. So you've got, you know, the process of your liver and your kidneys that help clean a lot of that stuff out. When you smoke cannabis, it gets absorbed into your bloodstream directly through the capillaries in your lungs. Mm-hmm. So that's issue number one that suggests we shouldn't be comparing it to food. Number two, this is still, again, it's a fledgling industry, and we have high pesticide find rates in agriculture, like blueberries and strawberries, corn, etc. Those industries have been around for a long time. Those producers know what they do, what they're doing. They have resources available to them. They can get pesticide applicators licenses. They can go to their local extension service if they have a mold or pests or something, so that they can learn the appropriate products to use and when to use them, how late to use them in the cycle, and how much of that product to use to ensure that the final finished product is still going to be safe for consumption. and meet regulatory compliance requirements. Cannabis producers don't have those resources available to them. It just hasn't historically existed because it's so new to the regulatory compliance space. If there are products out there that are found to have, like fish, for example, we had a mercury scare not that long ago with fish. I think it was in Oregon, where there was a high level of mercury that was found through random testing in fish. Mm-hmm. And so when that happens, the Department of Agriculture or you know, if it's a federal level, it would be the FDA that would come in and do it, would start an investigation in that. And if they find that a lot of that product is contaminated, then they're going to move into a risk-based testing schema, which creates a need for much more extensive and rigorous testing of products like that across the market. So in that case, we would see most of that same type of fish getting tested for mercury. So if you look at the fail rates in cannabis, we see them so high that in most cases, it's well beyond what any risk-based testing schema would, or what would be a catalyst for a risk-based testing schema for any ag products. So really, cannabis is not treated differently than ag products or than any other product that should be tested. It's still fledgling and it's still a high-risk product because we find so many contaminants in it still. So I think that the comparison is really, it's a poor comparison. And cannabis should really be, I think, looked at more as
medicine,
as having a need for that more extensive testing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There's another point I'd like to make on that, is that a significant and increasing proportion of cannabis users are using it for strictly medical purposes.
Exactly.
These are... You know, many of these people have already compromised immune systems, and you know, their bodies are less able to deal with toxins that they may be exposed to. They're trying to heal their bodies. You know, many people, you know, our flagship product, our decarboxylated oil, is consumed by people who are dealing with, you know, life-threatening illnesses or you know, seeking end-of-life, you know, compassionate care. These are people who absolutely need access to products that have been rigorously tested for toxins.
Yeah, okay. I feel like any product for consumption should be rigorously tested, you know, especially for medical reasons, but all consumers should be protected.
Yeah, we need to know what's happening with the products that we consume. And I think...
Yeah, also, like with cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, though it didn't exist until recently, mm-hmm. maybe we didn't know what it was in the first place or something like that. How do we know how pesticides are going to react with long-term usage through smoking it or vaping it, when we don't even recognize that that could be an issue in the first place? So better to just solve it now instead of waiting to figure out long-term effects.
Amen.
That's a really good point. The research just hasn't been done on that yet. A lot of people talk in the cannabis industry mm-hmm. about how we've been smoking this stuff for 7 years mm-hmm. or for 20 years or for, you know, since the 70s or whatever, and we haven't had any problems. But how do we know that we don't have problems? How do you know that person didn't have that heart attack or that stroke, or why you don't have cholesterol issues, or, you know, we just don't know what is, you know,
what the repercussions
are. What might from if it's not from this. We also, in a comment to reply to Cedar's comment earlier about medical patients, some of these pesticides that we find are actually, we find in cannabis fairly often, are really pretty nasty compounds that really shouldn't be used on anything that is being consumed by humans. For example, there's one that we find fairly frequently called chlorpheniramine. Chlorpheniramine has a lot of peer-reviewed articles about it. It causes demyelination. So for MS patients specifically who have issues with their deterioration of their myelin sheath, smoking something with chlorpheniramine in it could exacerbate their illness rather than help them. This particular compound in studies has shown to be lethal to birds. And there's even a couple of papers out there that show that it has caused paralysis and even death in humans.
Wow. Yeah, they're cancer causing. A lot of those pesticides have warnings on them that say that they can cause cancer. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I want to focus on this, but I want to get you guys on for another show because this is one of the main issues of, okay, let's like at least deschedule cannabis from one so we can actually start doing some research on this. Like, it's just insane how I don't think people think about it as much as they really should be. Like, this is still federally illegal. We need the support to be able to do the research and the testing. And God, like then with 280E going away, then people would be able to afford lab testing so much more. It's just so sad that it's the federal, you know,
ban and resistance
on this. I don't think people realize that this is still federally illegal in much more regulated markets where it's really crippling us as a community as we advance.
Still a public health concern.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one last question for you guys. We like to think about solutions. You know, we got you on the show because we realized there's a problem that needs to be addressed. And I want to make sure that all of you guys have had the opportunity to kind of address that problem and kind of let us know, like for those people that are listening, that now we've talked and really understood kind of how pesticides could affect the cannabis operators and the public. We talked about, you know, the timeline that's happened in Oregon and this upcoming regulation, right? And these draft rules. If I was in Oregon, would want to vote no. Like, please, let's not do this. So what kind of solution can we give our listeners right now?
Well, let's see. It's March 17th. So 2 days ago, I believe that the public comment period opened up for the Oregon Health Authority. So every individual can submit comments to the Oregon Health Authority.
Okay.
I don't have the exact information handy right here, but you can go to the OHA website and
we'll put it in our show notes. We'll make sure that everybody in our show notes has access to all the information that we've talked about. So all they have to do is click. Okay, yeah. So they can do that.
And then the other thing... I think that it would be an excellent idea for people in Oregon to write letters and send comments to the Joint Committee, the Oregon Legislature Joint Committee, mm-hmm. Which is humorously and accurately named. Mm-hmm. There's 10 legislators who, basically decide the legislative course of the cannabis industry. And, they obviously have a tremendous power. So I think they would be the second people to write to after the OHA.
Okay.
There's a group of labs and even some producers who have joined forces together to form a political action committee called Oregonians for Public Health and Safety. This organization is really working hard in the legislature right now to try to improve the rules for testing, and we're hoping to, our primary objective at this point is to not allow the state to adopt the repeal of pesticide testing on cannabis. And we could definitely use some help. So if there are listeners out there who are interested in helping us to fight this cause, we do have an opportunity to donate on the website. It's at the name of the organization, again, is Oregonians for Public Health and Safety. And the website is at orpublichealth.com.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Thank you guys so much for joining our show. We really like to focus on things that are, up to date and happening and that can impact, society. And it was like a special thing that we wanted to do because it's very important. And we hope that all of our listeners understand that and that we can help you in any way.
And considering that Oregon is leading the country, out of all states in their required pesticide testing, we're watching you. Like, what happens in Oregon is going to have a ripple effect
to California, especially
to everywhere. So we are behind what you guys want to do. We think that stringent testing and requirements is necessary for us to grow and create a superior product that's safe for everybody. So keep up the good work.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
thank you.
Okay, recap of Oregon Lab. Wow, that was such an interesting conversation with CO2 company, Siskiyou Sungrown, and OG Analytical Lab about lab testing in Oregon and all of the things that the proposed change in legislation could impact. What do you think?
And even beyond that, I didn't realize they were the only state requiring pesticide testing on everything, yeah. Which I would have thought Colorado and Washington had those kinds of regulations.
I think they have the list, but I think the severity, the severity that Oregon does.
Yeah, well, in those states, they can catch you using testing, but in Oregon, that's mm-hmm. a complete barrier to entry if you don't pass your tests.
Yeah,
which, then I thought from the big, slowdown that shut a bunch of people down in Oregon when the rules passed, I thought it was because it was too stringent of testing, but it was just a matter of how many labs were available to do the testing.
Exactly, and I think that was probably the biggest misconception, right?
Well, it's the ones that have a lot to lose when the testing gets stronger or more required, those are the ones who speak the loudest, mm-hmm. fighting against it so that they can stay in business with subpar quality.
Totally. But what do you think?
I think it should be more stringent because people have proven that they can operate with a higher mandated pesticide testing program. And that should be the way it is everywhere. Because as we had mentioned in that conversation, when it comes to inhalation, it's not the same as when you eat something and your gut biome can kill everything, filter it out. But when you're inhaling something straight into your blood, that's scary, especially the one that she had been talking about that can destroy your myelin sheath, which is the coating around your nerve endings or all of your nerves.
Yeah.
So if you have MS, it could kill you.
Yeah, and that's so ironic because a lot of people with MS use cannabis. And exactly. So that's why it's so important to have these stringent guidelines and testing, and this better not pass. And I think from a business perspective, if you do it right from the very beginning, like Kevin's company, like they have good manufacturing procedures. They have best practices, right? So I think maybe people are like, it's going to be so expensive. If you know how to manage your business, it's going to be a marginal cost.
And you can charge more for a quality product to cover that. I mean,
exactly.
There is a way to do it that works. I think that's a selling point in itself when you know that it's clean, all considering. I mean, what about all of these medical patients in all of these other states, California especially, mm-hmm. that we don't even know?
We don't know. And I think that's the scariest part.
Yeah, absolutely.
So final takeaway?
Stringent testing should be mandatory. Full comprehensively screen pesticides. If it's concentrates, residual solvents, even though we didn't talk about it, but it should all, at every step, be tested.
Absolutely.
To catch the contamination. And if you can't keep up with that, you shouldn't be in business.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if you're still listening, because this is a little bit longer of an episode, please go to our website where we have the show notes on this. And please click the links where we, say how you can help us. Us and I guess the movement of making sure that this doesn't go through. It's very important that you go. So liv-consulting.com/podcast and just search for the show notes here.
You can make a difference.
You can make a difference. So thank you so much for joining Cannabis Business Minds.
Yes. Have a great day or evening.
And rest of your week.
Yep.
Cannabis Business Minds is recorded by Simone Samaluka-Radzins and Kristen Yoder. Produced and edited by Gustavo Bulgach at East Venice Recording Studios. Podcast music is by Ketza. You can find more episodes of the show on our website, liv-consulting.com, and you can also subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.